We're going to read from God's Word now, and the reading's found on page 553 in the Church Bibles. That's Ecclesiastes and chapter 1, and we're beginning to read from verse 12, and we'll read through to the end of chapter 2. So it's Ecclesiastes chapter 1 and verse 12. I, the preacher, have been king over Israel in Jerusalem, and I applied my heart to seek and to search out by wisdom all that is done under heaven. It is an unhappy business that God has given to the children of man to be busy with. I have seen everything that is done under the sun, and behold, all is vanity and a striving after wind. What is crooked cannot be made straight. What is lacking cannot be counted. I said in my heart, I have acquired great wisdom, surpassing all who were over Jerusalem before me. And my heart has had great experience of wisdom and knowledge. And I applied my heart to know wisdom and to know madness and folly. I perceived that this also is but a striving after the wind. For in much wisdom is much vexation, and he who increases knowledge increases sorrow. I said in my heart, come now, I will test you with pleasure. Enjoy yourself. But behold, this also was vanity. I said of laughter, it's mad, and of pleasure, what use is it? I searched with my heart how to cheer my body with wine, my heart still guiding me with wisdom, and how to lay hold on folly, till I might see what was good for the children of man to do under heaven during the few days of their life. I made great works. I built houses and planted vineyards for myself. I made myself gardens and parks and planted in them all kinds of fruit trees. I made myself pools with which to water the forest of the growing trees. I bought male and female servants, slaves, and had slaves who were born in my house. I had also great possessions of herds and flocks, more than any who had been before me in Jerusalem. I also gathered for myself silver and gold and the treasures of kings and provinces. I got singers, both men and women, and many concubines, the delight of the children of man. So I became great and surpassed all who were before me in Jerusalem. Also my wisdom remained with me, and whatever my eyes desired, I did not keep from them. I kept my heart from no pleasure, for my heart found pleasure in all my toil, and that was my reward for all my toil. Then I considered all that my hands had done, and the toil I had expended in doing it, and behold, it was vanity and a striving after wind, and there was nothing to be gained under the sun. So I turned to consider wisdom and madness and folly. For what can the man do who comes after the king? Only what has already been done. Then I saw that there is more gain in wisdom than in folly, as there is more gain in light than in darkness. The wise person has his eyes in his head, but the fool walks in darkness. And yet I perceived that the same event happens to all of them. Then I said in my heart, what happens to the fool will happen to me also. Why then have I been so very wise? And I said in my heart that this also is vanity. For of the wise, as of the fool, there is no enduring remembrance, seeing that in the days to come all will have been long forgotten. How the wise dies, so just like the fool. So I hated life, because what is done under the sun was grievous to me, for all is vanity and a striving after wind. I hated all my toil in which I toiled under the sun, seeing that I must leave it to the man who will come after me, and who knows whether he will be wise or a fool. Yet he will be master of all for which I toiled and used my wisdom under the sun. This also is vanity. So I turned about and gave my heart up to despair over all the toil of my labours under the sun, because sometimes a person who has toiled with wisdom and knowledge and skill must leave everything to be enjoyed by someone who did not toil for it. This also is vanity and a great evil. What has a man from all the toil and striving of heart with which he toils beneath the sun? For all his days are full of sorrow, and his work is a vexation. Even in the night his heart does not rest. This also is vanity. There is nothing better for a person than he should eat and drink and find enjoyment in his toil. This also I saw is from the hand of God. For apart from him, who can eat or who can have enjoyment? For to the one who pleases him, God has given wisdom and joy and knowledge. But to the sinner, he has given the business of gathering and collecting, only to give to the one who pleases God. This also is vanity and a striving after wind. If you've ever read John Bunyan's Pilgrim's Progress, well, if you haven't, you ought to. Can I just say that? And it really is a blessing, and something every Christian really should read. It's a classic. But if you have read it, I'm sure you'll remember the part where Christian and Faithful arrive in the town called Vanity. We're told, Bunyan says, when they were got out of the wilderness, they presently saw a town before them. And the name of that town is Vanity. And of course, he goes on to describe the fact that a fair is held continually every day of the year in Vanity. And it's called Vanity Fair, of course. And he describes in that part of the story the troubles that Christian and Faithful had there. And of course, Faithful himself is put to death in Vanity Fair because of their objection to them. It's a description of the world, isn't it? And the book of Ecclesiastes is basically telling us that that's exactly where we live. And I'm sure that's where Bunyan, of course, got the idea from. But he's telling us all the way through this book that that's exactly where we live. He's looking at this world without God. He's looking at the world under the sun, as he describes it. And it's his way of drawing a horizontal line, as it were, and cutting God out of the picture. He's looking at life in this world under the sun and asking the question, well, what's it really all about? What is life in this world without God? And his conclusion, he tells us the conclusion of his book right at the beginning in verse 2, but he goes on to explain it, doesn't he? And it's there in verse 2 of Ecclesiastes chapter 1. Vanity of vanities, he says. Vanity of vanities, says the preacher. Vanity of vanities, all is vanity. And he uses the word again and again and again. And when you consider life in this world without God, that's all you can say about it. That's what life is. And it horrifies him, doesn't it? In the passage that we read, I don't know if you noticed, but in verses 17 and 18, he uses some very strong words, doesn't he? In verse 17, he says, "So I hated life because of what is done under the sun. It was grievous to me, for all is vanity and a striving after the wind." He says similarly in verse 18, rather, he says, "I hated all my toil in which I toiled under the sun, seeing that I must leave it to the man who will come after me." And he uses some very strong language there. He says, "I hated life," he says. If you were to try and put the book of Ecclesiastes into a work of art, I wonder how you would. I wonder what work of art you would use. Perhaps I can't think of a better description of the work of the book of Ecclesiastes than the famous The Scream. You've seen that work of art, haven't you, by Edvard Munch, where this ghost-like figure is standing on the banks of a shore and on this promenade, as it were. And the world behind him is deliberately just swirling around, isn't it? It's kind of, it's hard to make out what it is, really. And it's just sort of swirling and nothing's really straight. And even the character himself in the center of the picture, even his body is sort of swirling, isn't it? It's swerving, it's not straight. And as he thinks, it's almost as though Edvard Munch was saying there with that picture, that as he thinks about the world in which we're living, and all he could do is cover his ears, and you've got this silent scream, haven't you? And it's a very haunting picture, isn't it? But that's where the preacher is, isn't it? As he looks at life under the sun. There's a commentary that's been written for, or a series of commentaries really, that are written for children. And the author writing these books, when he came to the wisdom, what we call the wisdom literature in scriptures, that's Job and the Psalms, Ecclesiastes and Proverbs and Song of Solomon. When he came to writing these books, he gave his commentary a title, and he said he called it simply Thinking It Through. And I think that's a wonderful description, really, of the book of Ecclesiastes, isn't it? It's a good title, because that's exactly what the preacher in this book wants us to do. He says there is a madness to it all, isn't there? He described that for us last week. We were thinking there in chapter 1 of the way that he describes this world, and it all just seems to swirl around, just like in that picture by Munch. It's going around in circles where the sun comes up one day and it goes down and it rushes around to the start again and off we go again and then it comes down and so on. And the waters are doing the same. They're going up into the sky and raining on the land and going out in the rivers and coming back in, and everything seems to go round and round in circles. And of course, he's describing us and he's describing our life. And he's saying, well, what's the reason of it all? What's the point of it all? We just seems to be going round in circles, and it's all madness. And what he wants us to do in this book is to think. He wants us to think it through. And it's almost as though Ecclesiastes is saying to us, look, don't just accept the status quo. Don't just accept that that's the way the world is and follow everybody else. Think it through. Because there is an answer. It's like the song from the 60s, I think it was Cilla, that sang a song. What's it all about, Alfie? You remember what she says? What's it all about, Alfie? Is it just for the moment that we live? Is that it? Are we just here for the moment and then gone? Is it really just a case of eat, drink and be merry, for tomorrow we die anyway? Is it just a question of, well, enjoy yourself, just enjoy life, because you're not here for long, and then when you're gone, that's it. And the preacher wants us to think. He wants us to ask questions. In fact, he's brutal in it, isn't he, here in this book? He forces us. Someone has said it's almost as though he drags us by the scruff of the neck and forces us to look at something we don't really want to look at. Because nobody really asks this question, do they? You ask somebody tomorrow, what's the meaning of life? And see what reaction you'll get. I don't know, shrug of the shoulders maybe? Oh, don't bother me with all of that kind of stuff. You know, what's the meaning of, I mean, you couldn't ask a more important question, could you? What are we here for? What's the meaning of life? And yet people really don't want to ask that question. But I think they don't want to ask it because they're afraid that there's no answer. But there is, you see. There is. But it's not an easy, instant, slick, just answer off the tongue. No, we need to think it through. And that's what the book of Ecclesiastes is here for. He's posed the question in the first 11 verses. And now in verse 12 and following, he goes on. He goes on a quest. And he conducts a series of experiments in the passage that we've read, a series of experiments that lead him to a conclusion at the end of the passage. Now, as we've mentioned at the previously in the introduction, for reasons that I'm not going to go into now, but if you want to go into it, if you haven't heard, you could listen to the first of the series on Solomon, on this book rather. But I believe that this is probably not Solomon that's writing the book of Ecclesiastes. But we are clearly meant to have Solomon in mind. We are meant to be looking at life through the eyes of that great man. And the preacher, what he's doing really here, he's seeking to create the perfect environment for his experiments. He's going on this quest and he's going to ask a very, very important question. And he's going to create a series of experiments that we're going to look at in a moment. And it's almost as though he's saying, look, what I want you to do is to imagine the man who has everything. Think of Solomon. There was no one wiser. There was no one richer. There was no one more powerful in all the earth at his time, in his time. So let's ask the question. What does this world have to offer a man of his genius, his wealth, and his power? Imagine it. You see, our problem very often is we think to ourselves, well, if I could only get this, if I was just a bit more wiser, if I was a bit richer, if I was a bit younger, if I was a bit this and I was a bit that, well, then I'd be able to know. Well, Ecclesiastes says to us, no, hang on a minute. I want you to put yourself in the shoes of the one man who has had everything that this world has to offer. Here's Solomon, as it were. And what did he find? What did he find in all of his life? Did he find satisfaction in the things of this world? Is that where meaning is found? Well, let's look at the experiments that he conducts here in this passage. There are three of them, basically. There are three of them. First of all, he turns to wisdom and knowledge, verses 16 and 17. He says, I have said in my heart, I have acquired great wisdom, surpassing all who were over Jerusalem before me. And my heart has had great experience of wisdom and knowledge. And I applied my heart to know wisdom and to know madness and folly. And I perceive that this also is but a striving after the wind. He looks to wisdom and knowledge. Now, we need to be very careful here. Because Ecclesiastes is not talking about wisdom in what we would call the normal biblical sense of the word wisdom. When Solomon wrote the book of Proverbs, he said, remember, the fear of the Lord is the beginning of wisdom. In other words, if you are wise at all, then you will know what the fear of the Lord is. And if you do not know what the fear of the Lord is, you haven't even begun to be truly wise. And he says there in the book of Proverbs, let me just quote a couple of verses to you, if I may, from chapter 4. This is Solomon writing, and he says this. He says in verse 5 of chapter 4, he says, get wisdom, get insight. Do not forget and do not turn away from the words of my mouth. Do not forsake her and she will keep you. Love her and she will guard you. The beginning of wisdom is this. Get wisdom and whatever you get insight. Prize her highly and she will exalt you. She will honor you if you embrace her. She will place a head of grace, of graceful garland on your head. She will bestow on you a beautiful crown. So, of course, in the book of Proverbs, you see, Solomon there is describing wisdom, and he's saying, look, this is the one thing you need, above all things. Whatever you get wisdom. That's the one thing to prize. That's the one thing to go after. And yet here in this book, he says, the writer here says, I perceive that this also is a striving after the wind. Well, what is it? What are we to believe? Is it the treasure above all treasures that we are to prize and go after? Or is it something that we should just, well, what a waste of time that is? How are we to understand it? Well, the answer is very simple, really, and that is that Ecclesiastes here is not talking about wisdom in the same sense that the book of Proverbs is. The book of Ecclesiastes here is clearly talking about a worldly wisdom, because the whole passage is punctuated, isn't it? Nine times in the verses that we read, I don't know if you noticed, but nine times in that passage he mentions that phrase, under the sun, beneath the sun, under heaven. He keeps on mentioning it, doesn't he? All the time, all the way through. Under heaven, under the sun, under heaven, and so on. Because what he's describing here is the kind of wisdom that is described in the book of James. He contrasts, doesn't he, this wisdom that comes down from above and this wisdom that is of the world. And the book of Ecclesiastes has that worldly wisdom in view. It's almost as though he says to himself, well, what I'm going to do now is I'm going to try philosophy. I'm going to try and get understanding. I'm going to fill my mind with all the learning that I possibly can. I'm going to pursue knowledge and understanding. Everything that this world has to offer. Everything without God, the worldly wisdom that you can find all around you. Well, that's what I'm going to go after, he says. And that's what he does. But of course, his conclusion is there, isn't it, in verse 18. He says, for in much wisdom is much vexation, and he who increases knowledge increases sorrow. Or verse 15, what is crooked cannot be made straight, and what is lacking cannot be counted. You see what he's saying? When you cut God out of the picture, when you're looking at this world and just under the sun, everything that's done under this world, when you look for that kind of knowledge and that kind of wisdom and the answers to big questions, but without God, what do you get? Well, it's like a jigsaw puzzle without some of the pieces. I don't know if you've ever done a jigsaw. Have you ever done one without, and you found at the end that there were some pieces missing? How frustrating was that? Incredible. It is, isn't it? Because you go round and round in circles trying to find this piece and it's not there. And that's what he's saying there. What is lacking cannot be counted. And he's saying that the wisdom of this world has got big holes in it, of course. And how frustrating is that? But that's all that it can offer, isn't it? There's great gaps in it. And it just leaves you wondering. And the more you realize the more you know, the more you realize that you don't know. When it comes to worldly wisdom. Wasn't that Plato? Wasn't that one of the things that he said? He's famous for saying, the only thing I know is that I know nothing. I mean, what an admission. It's very humble of him to say so, but what an admission, isn't it? What an incredible thing to say. One of the greatest thinkers that has ever walked on this planet, and yet he says, I don't know anything. The only thing I really know is that I don't know anything. And don't you find that to be true even today? On the Radio 2, I don't know if they still do this, but years ago they used to have this program. I think it was on every Friday. But they used to have a little slot on Radio 2 called What Makes Us Human, I think they call it. What Makes Us Human. And you used to listen to these people, and they'd have all sorts of famous and very clever people that would come on the show, and they would answer this question, and they'd give like a few minutes of an explanation as to what actually makes us human. And some of them were brilliant thinkers, the cleverest people that our country has got to offer, and some from other places as well. And as you listen to them and as you think of what they're saying, you realize that they haven't got a clue. They're just taking a stab in the dark. Well, this is what makes us human. And they haven't got a clue. There's gaping holes in the knowledge of this world, and it gets worse, doesn't it? Not only are there gaping holes in it when God is left out, but look at the first part of verse 15. He says, what is crooked cannot be made straight. What is crooked cannot be made straight. And I think what Solomon is saying there is that all the knowledge in the world can't straighten this world out. Isn't that true? Knowledge reveals what is right and straight, perhaps, but it's powerless to effect change. There's something twisted about the world in which we're living, isn't there? And we know it's not right. But how can it be straightened? Tony Blair had the answer, didn't he? Education, education, education. That's the answer. 1997, wasn't it, when he swept into power. I've got the answer to all our problems. Education, education, education. Well, did he win? Did he succeed? Was that the answer? Of course it wasn't. Understanding is good. Philosophy, wisdom, the worldly wisdom. There is something good about it, isn't there? But it's powerless. It's got these gaping holes in it, and it's also powerless. And that's So clear, isn't it? I was just thinking this week when I was preparing this, I was thinking of when I was an apprentice. That's a long time ago now. nearly 40 years ago, I became an apprentice. I think it's just over, actually, now. Anyway, I became an apprentice, and I remember speaking to our foreman and one of the older boys who used to come in. He just, I think he was in his 70s, and he used to just do a day or so a week, just a bit of part-time work. And I remember talking to these two older men, and they would tell us of what it was like when they were apprentices in their youth. And they would tell us that, you know, there weren't many cars on the road in those days. And what they had to do was to load all their tools and the wood that they needed for the day, and they would push a cart on big wheels, and they would just push it to the job where they had to go, and then they would work all day and without the electric saws that we've got and everything today, and they would do their work, and then they'd push the cart home again, and that was the way that it was. And, well, what a difference now, isn't it? What a world. I mean, it's incredible, isn't it? In the last 100 years, there's just been an explosion of knowledge, isn't it? And technology, and it's quite incredible. Those men that I've just been talking about, they would have known nothing. They would never have been able to imagine such things as flat-screen TVs and the internet and having a phone in your pocket wherever you go. And it would just never enter their minds, would it? A little computer in their own pockets. There's been this explosion of knowledge in the last 100 years. But is life any better? Has the crooked been straightened by it all? I would suggest that it's worse, isn't it, today? Isn't the generation that's growing up now more afraid than life than we ever were in the past? I mean, we weren't afraid to go out in the day, were we? And play in the fields and all that kind of thing. We weren't afraid of that kind of thing. We didn't feel that we had to carry knives around with us to protect ourselves, did we? And yet that's on the news all the time now. What was crooked, what is crooked, cannot be straightened by all the knowledge that this world has to offer. It's vexation. And he who increases knowledge increases sorrow, because he knows more about it. And so he turns from worldly wisdom, doesn't he, to pleasure. In verses two, in chapter 2, in verses 1 to 3, you see what he says there. I said in my heart, come now, I'll test you with pleasure, enjoy yourself. But behold, this also was vanity. I said of laughter, it's mad, and of pleasure, what use is it? I searched with all my heart how to cheer my body with wine, but my heart still guiding me with wisdom, and how to lay hold on folly till I might see what was good for the children of man to do under heaven during the few days of their life. Again, isn't that so up to date? The world in which we're living today is so full of fun and laughter and wine and folly. And it seems here that Ecclesiastes is saying, well, I've decided to let my hair down. I've tried to search for purpose and meaning in wisdom and understanding and knowledge. And maybe that's made me too straight-laced. So I've decided I'm going to live it up for a bit. I've decided I'm going to eat, drink and be merry, for tomorrow we die, and I'm going to give myself no, I'm not going to hold back at all from any kind of pleasure. So I'm going to go out and I'm going to do this and I'm going to do that. And he gives himself to enjoying himself. He says, come now, I'll test you with pleasure. Enjoy yourself. Go on, live it up. And isn't that our generation again? We don't live in an age of reason today, do we? I think we actually live in the age of absurdity. And we see it everywhere. We see it in the society at large, which thinks that the best thing they can do is just drink themselves silly at the weekend. Or even in the arts, where a pile of bricks is considered to be art, where an unkempt bed is viewed with awe and wonder. Oh, what a wonderful work of art that is. I mean, it's absurd, isn't it? And it's exactly the same in philosophy. I mean, it's no different. You've got existentialism there that's been going on for the last few decades and so on. And existentialism, which says simply there is no meaning to life, so live it up. Make the most of the time you've got because you're only here for a moment. You might as well make the most of it. I was reading this little book. It's very helpful on this book of Ecclesiastes. But he says this, the author refers to Sartre, Jean-Paul Sartre, who was anything but a Christian. He was an atheist and he was proud of it, and an existentialist. And he said this about him. He says, Sartre would have been proud. He says, that's the way to get through life. You just enjoy what you can, try to make the most of things, meager as it is, and then you die. Much of life's offerings are nothing. Listen to this. He says, much of life's offerings are nothing but nothing more than anesthesia, dulling the pain of a meaningless existence, or distractions keeping us from becoming overwhelmed by the senselessness and hopelessness of it all. See what he's saying? The things that this world has to offer, it's just there to dull the pain. Because if you really think, if you do what Ecclesiastes is saying, it's so depressing for the people, for the man of the world. This life is so utterly meaningless. So, well, let's live it up. Let's try and hide that fact. Let's cut that thought out of our mind. Let's bury our heads in the sand and just go after the things that hedonism can give to us and so on. And Ecclesiastes says it's mad. Because it may gratify, but it will never satisfy. Because there's a big difference between those two things, isn't there? We gratify the feelings and the instincts, the animal instincts of our human existence. But that's also fleeting, isn't it? And it's never enough, and we always need more next time. But these things will never really satisfy the human heart. And so from pleasure and from wisdom, he turns finally to hard work in verses 4 to 11. He turns to hard work. And again, there are many people that are doing that today, aren't they? They don't want to waste their life by drinking it away and wasting all their time. And so what do? Well, they decide that they're going to work hard and they're going to find meaning in hard work. And so they throw themselves at it, don't they? And there were some people like that. You've probably met people like that. And you know what it's like. They never stop, do they? And they make you feel tired just looking at them. And you wonder how they do it. And there's something admirable about it, isn't there? It's certainly more admirable than drinking your life away, that experiment. And there's something very admirable about working hard and trying to make the best for yourself and gaining things and acquiring to yourself more and more things. Well, you know, what's wrong with that? They're a world away from the wasters of this world. And so that's what the preacher does now, isn't it? He says, go on. Instead of enjoying yourself, I'm going to work hard. And then he describes it in verses 4 to 11. We won't read it now, but he says, I built houses and planted vineyards and I did this and I did that. And I've done so much. And then in verse 11, he considers it, doesn't he? He says, then I considered all that my hands had done and the toil that I had expended in doing it. And behold, all was vanity and a striving after the wind, and there was nothing to be gained under the sun. What's the point of it all? As one of the poets has said, what is life if full of care, you have no time to stand and stare? And that's pointless as well. And he gives himself to that, but he finds that there's no answer there either, that there's no meaning in that. I used to know a bricklayer in the building company and on the sites where I worked some years ago. And I can honestly say I've never met anyone like him. He was a workhorse from start to finish. He worked all day, hardly ever stopped. And then when he went home, he went and did his own jobs. And he told me once that he only ever had 2 evenings off a week. He worked all of the time. Went home, had a quick bite to eat, and then he was out doing his own little foreigners and own little jobs. And He worked and worked and worked. And then his wife left him because she never saw him. And the kids didn't really want to know him because they'd grown up without him. And he'd given himself to work and to work and to work. And what did he get for it? I don't know if you've heard that. There's an old song. Work my fingers to the bone. And what do you get? Bony fingers. And that's it, isn't it? That's what the preacher's telling us here, isn't it? What's the point of it all? And all of these experiments, you see, fail. They all tell him the same thing. It's all a striving after the wind. It's all meaningless. It's vanity. And they all fail. Why? For one main reason. He gets to the heart of the problem in verse 12 and following, and in verse 18 and following. But he gets to the heart of the matter there. Because what we are really looking for is permanence, isn't it? We're looking for permanence, and we can't get it in this world. Let me just read a few verses there from you, from verse 12. He says, "So I turned to consider wisdom and madness and folly. For what can the man do who comes after the king? Only what has already been done. Then I saw that there is more gain in wisdom than in folly, for there is more gain in light than in darkness. The wise person has eyes in his head, but the fool walks around in darkness. And yet I perceive that the same event happens to them all. Then I said in my heart, what happens to the fool will happen to me also. Why then have I been so very wise? What's the point? And I said in my heart that this also is vanity. For the wise, as for the fool, there is no enduring remembrance, seeing that in the days to come, all will have been long forgotten, how the wise dies just like the fool. So I hated life because of what is done under the sun, was grievous to me, for all is vanity and a striving after the wind." Do you see what he's saying? He's saying death, you see, is the great leveller, isn't it? The wise and the fool, they come to the same end. The rich and the poor, the hard worker and the waster, it all comes to the same end. And death makes a mockery of it all, doesn't it? All the efforts that we put into this world without God, it's all nothing. And there'll be no remembrance of us when we've gone. Will there? Not for long. Can anybody remember the name of your great-grandparents? I can't. I wouldn't have a clue. Well, it's not that long ago, is it? And we're gone. We're soon forgotten, says Ecclesiastes. You see, on Who Do You Think You Are, don't you, all the time, that program. They go into their past and they discover people that they've long forgotten. They've been long forgotten. And our fleeting life will soon be over. And all the wisdom and the fun and the hard work that we put into this world, well, what will come of it then? He says it'll all be handed over to the next generation. And you don't even know what they're going to be like. Well, that was certainly true for Solomon, wasn't it? You have to wonder whether he must have known something. It was Rehoboam ruined his kingdom in a day. It didn't take him long. A day. But that's what he says here. It just makes a mockery of it all. And what becomes of my life then, and all the things that I've tried to gain now? So don't spend your life chasing after the wind. And then he comes to his final conclusions, and we close with this in verses 24. To 26. We're having to skip over quite a bit here, but look at verses 26 to 24, because here there's a big shift now. Here there's a big change. As I've said before, there are 9 references to under the sun in the passage that we read, right from chapter 1 and verse 12 through to verse 22. There's the last one in chapter 2. He says, "What has a man from all the toil and striving of heart with which he toils beneath the sun?" So all that time has been spent in the vanity, in this world under the sun without God. But then in verses 24 to 26, It's all about God, isn't it? So there's this big shift now, isn't there? He says, there is nothing better for a person than that he should eat and drink and find enjoyment in his toil. This also I saw is from the hand of God. For apart from him, who can eat and who can have enjoyment? For to the one who pleases him, God has given wisdom and knowledge and joy. But to the sinner, he has given the business of gathering and collecting, only to give to the person who pleases God. This also is vanity and a striving after the wind. But you see, God is in the picture again now. And he looks at life from the other point of view, doesn't he? From over the sun. And looks at life and asks the question now with God in mind. And what's the answer to it all? Well, basically what Ecclesiastes is saying there in those verses, basically it comes down to this. Meaning and satisfaction can be found, but only in God. It has to be given. It's not inherent in man. It's not in us. It has to be given. You see what he says there? This also I saw was from the hand of God. For apart from him, who can eat and who can have enjoyment? You see what he's saying? That's where our reason is found. That's where satisfaction is found. That's the reason that life is so frustrating and unhappy in this world is that our relationship to God is not right. And in verse 26, he explains exactly why, doesn't he? For to the one who pleases him, God has given wisdom and knowledge and joy. But to the sinner, he has given the business of gathering and collecting, only to give to one who pleases God. It all comes down to this, you see, doesn't it? As our relationship to God. When I was a teenager, somebody gave me an LP. That's a long playing record for the younger ones. if you don't know what an LP is. I think they're back in fashion to some extent. But anyway, somebody gave me this LP and it was one of my favourite singers. But when they gave me this LP, my record player was broken at the time. And so I knew there was some wonderful music in there. But I couldn't get it out. Because LPs depend upon a record player, don't they? Without the record player, they are useless, meaningless. It's just a piece of plastic with grooves in it. And that's all it is, isn't it? And that's what he's telling us here about us. That's what he's saying about man. As Augustine said, you have made us for yourself, O Lord, and we are restless until our hearts find our rest in you. And that's what Ecclesiastes is saying. Man is meaningless without his maker. And until we are put right with him, until our relationship is right with God, we always will be meaningless and pointless, and we'll never find satisfaction. Nothing can substitute him. That's the point. And so all the wisdom and the fun and the entertainment and the hard work and the things that we accumulate, all the good things in this life, everything that we can gain for ourselves, it will never come to anything unless our relationship with him is right. Because he must give it. So how can we get right with him? Well, there's only one way. Jesus said, he that believes in me has everlasting life. Permanence. That's what we need. Without which nothing will make sense. Permanence. We have it in Christ. But you notice what Jesus says. He doesn't say he that believes in me will have everlasting life. He's not pointing to the future after we die. He's talking about now. He has it. Because we're put into a right relationship with God, aren't we, through Christ? Through faith in him. So for the Christian, life is not a question of here today and gone tomorrow. Eat, drink and be merry, for tomorrow we die. No, it's I am the resurrection and the life. He who believes in me will never die. And so I ask you, as we come to a close this evening, where are you looking for satisfaction? Honestly, where are you looking? Don't look to the broken systems of this world. They mock you, don't they? Jesus, remember in John 4, said to the woman at the well, whoever drinks this water will thirst again. Talking about her life. Whoever drinks this water will thirst again, the water of this life. Do you believe that? Really? Those words, someone has said, ought to be written large over every university, every library, every documentary that comes on the telly, every nightclub, every pub, every place of every workplace, every bank, every estate agent, everything. The things of this world, it ought to be written large over everything that this world has to offer. Whoever drinks this water will thirst again. The Rolling Stones, I'm quoting a lot of the old music today, aren't I? The Rolling Stones, they sung, I can't get no satisfaction, didn't they? And you remember what he says? I can't get no satisfaction, but I try and I try and I try. I'm not going to sing it. I try and I try and I try. You know what it's like? You can understand the world doing that. I can't get any satisfaction, but I'm going to try and I'm going to try and I'm going to try. But why do we do it? We know better, don't we? This world has nothing to offer, really. So we ought to hold very lightly the things that we have in this world. We thank God for them. But at the end of the day, what are they? Trinkets. Tinsel. It's not gold, is it? Why do we try? We ought to know better. You remember what Jesus says in the Gospels? He says, for the Gentiles seek after all these things, and your heavenly Father knows that you need them all. But seek first the kingdom of God and his righteousness, and all these things will be added to you as well. Is he our priority? Do you really believe that true joy and true meaning and true satisfaction can only really be found in him and in his kingdom? Seek first the kingdom of God and his righteousness. That means far more than anything you will ever get from this world. And if you don't believe it, well, what are we talking about? What are we doing? Wasting our time? Are we just chasing after the wind? May these things be meaningful to us and have an effect in our lives. Let us seek first his kingdom and his righteousness. Amen.